greetings to you today, or as we say in old country, here's not gonna yes you said oh yeah, do you sing it here? Here's not gonna yes you said oh yeah, do you sing it here? We had mix up on this particular session. Our scheduled speaker had to go out of town, and so, as oft happens, Brother Schneider pick up slack. He will tell you what this is all about, but I'll give you a quick summary. He calls this denigration of Yahshua in the Talmud, the story of the monk Donin, who converted to Christianity from Judaism in 13th century, and how he tried so hard to get the Talmud completely destroyed on account of what he thought was descriptions in there of Yahshua. Now, whether they are or not, we leave it up to you, but Brother Schneider will give you some background, and then you decide. Oh yes, of course, this is your host, Bogdan G. Shroomkoff, recently arriving back from old country, where I have been recommissioned to take a place in the armed forces in Ukraine, which is old country for me, in this current civil war and war against Russia, to which I hope there'll be time to give a short report. But here's Brother Schneider right now.
By the way, welcome to you. We're on Controversial Scriptures Forum number 2, Sunday special edition with Zed, who didn't show up. So he had to go visit his father or something like that. So rather than just say, let's postpone until next week, let's just go ahead and do something. I picked up this book online, The Jesus Mystery. And I'm about halfway through, I guess. There's no big mysteries here. Nothing you wouldn't learn right off the bat in seminary class. However, at least so far, I was interested in getting this book because I think that it will explain the 15 or 20 years difference in historical events between Josephus and Luke. You know, Josephus has a lot of characters in there that it looks like Luke used in the Acts of the Apostles. But there's chronologically about 15, 20 years different. It's like the events in Luke are put back 15 or 20 years from the same events or what we suppose are the same events in Josephus. So if you're into that kind of study, this is something that's probably beguiled you for a while, and it sure has beguiled me for a while as to where that 15, 20 years goes. But now that I have figured out who Luke is among historical references, I can understand it a little bit better why Luke might put it back. So I'm not prepared to do that, but I would sure like to go through it again. Actually, I put up a lecture by this author, Einhorn, in the podcast, where she explained some of it, and specifically some historical events and Lucan events that don't match up, but could, if time was shifted, if everything in Luke was 15 to 20 years later than it is. That's really worth listening to. I checked with Robert Eisenman on that as well. He said he has read this book and he gave it the nod because if you've read the New Testament Code, of course, or James, the brother of Jesus, you'll see that he finds the same thing. And anybody can find it if you've got a Josephus who want to do a little work. And in the Josephus, there are dates to which certain things happen. Like, for instance, the death of James. According to Josephus, it looks like it's about 62 AD. But in Luke, it's about 20 years earlier. That is, there's a mix-up there between James, the brother of John, and James, the brother of Jesus, Yahshua. And that's one of the pivot or anchor points between the two. There are several more. But in this book, there's an interesting chapter here I think you will probably know something about. I knew something about it, but there's a lot more here. It's in regards to certain names like Miriam, Maria, Mary, Pantera, Status, most of which are unfamiliar to us, except maybe Pantera might be interesting to us, or we might know a little about that. That is the supposed father of Yahshua. The story going among the Jews is that Yahshua's mother, who was a hairdresser, was either raped or prostituted herself by with a centurion, a Roman centurion that was stationed in Tyre, named Pantera, the panther. This was not given much publicity except among the Jews in the times, say, 200 AD and on. It was thought to be written because Yahshua was to be put down and his movement destroyed through the revelation that he was the son of a Roman centurion. And even at this time, 200 years after the fact, when the Mishnah was being written, there were so many Jews that were going over to belief in Yahshua that this story became pretty much then and today what Jews still say about him. You might be familiar with the Toledot Yeshu text that also comes from Jewish literature. The Toledot Yeshu is set about 100 years before Yahshua in the first century BC and shows in the text Yahshua, whom we are supposed to connect with Jesus of Nazareth, who's a sorcerer in Egypt, who discovers the sacred name, comes back to Israel to sell that name and to do acts of sorcery and magic in that name. But his main purpose is to gain money through it. The Toledot Yeshu is a very blasphemous text, but I think you can get it online if there's any reason you might want to read it. But it too gives us a picture, a very pejorative picture, of the one who was catching on as the savior of the world. And this has something to do with that particular subject. The references to Yahshua outside of the New Testament, most of which are Jewish, a couple of which are secular or historian or pagan. And I had read the Toledot Yeshu years ago. It, of course, is put back in an earlier time, but I can see why Jews would use it then and now to denigrate one of their own. It's a good chapter on the birth and childhood of Yahshua, and it really goes back to the Christian attempts to have the Talmud destroyed. The Talmud is the Mishnah, the oral law, and the Targums, the commentaries, which were evidently, back in the Dark Ages, were put together in one book and circulated, a very costly book. And the church, especially through one of its evangelists, was especially interested in getting rid of all the Talmud on account of its mocking of the Messiah. So there are three or four passages in there, especially maybe two in the Mishnah, that the name is kind of garbled, or a different name is used, or a mysterious name is used, where the church try to connect that name, of course, with Jesus, whom they worship. And because of the use of this name and the various pejorative names for Jesus, that this was to be destroyed. I'll just go into a little of that right now, and maybe if we got time, we'll go on to Pantera. Understand one thing, and that is, I believe in Yahshua. I believe in his divinity, and that he is returning as coming secular king of this world. However, when anything comes up that smacks of the historicity of Yahshua, I want to read positive or negative, because I'm one of the few, maybe like you, that think it is important to know the historical man rather than just the Jesus of faith. I know the Jesus of faith has brought us this far, but I think so many people are very much afraid of looking into his historical life. In fact, many times when I've talked about this in the church, I've been told, why is that important? We know Jesus now, except the Jesus we know is always my Jesus, the Jesus I know, to the point where so many people go around these days saying things like, the Lord told me this, and the Lord told me that, and the Lord told me something about you. I don't know if you get that, but I get that all the time. People trying to give me messages that their Jesus have given them, and I look at them all, but I would think that if their Jesus had something to say to me, that my Jesus would say it. Everybody thinks the other person ought to be perfect, but not themselves. So I think that it's just another matter of control. And I'm going to tell you about this evangelist that tried very hard to take control of anything that was historical about Yahshua in his day and tried to destroy it. All right, now Lena Einhorn is talking about the Talmud here. She says it was put together between the years 170 and 600, that's CE. The Mishnah part, then the Jerusalem Gemara, and the Babylonian Gemara. But already in those days, life for the Jews had began to be colored by conflicts between Christianity and Judaism. The so-called disputations, more or less voluntary debates between representatives of Christianity and Judaism, started to become common as early as during the first centuries after Messiah. At first, they were rancorous and sarcastic, but like the arguments between members of the same household, they're essentially harmless. With the embracing of Christianity in the Roman Empire in the fourth century, however, the debates are accompanied by bans. The first ban, I would imagine, in that century was the so-called Arian heresy. I don't know that everybody on here today isn't an Arian in their understanding of the Messiah, but that was not permitted, and it was routed out with military force. In 553, the Byzantine Emperor Justinian issues an order forbidding the use of Hebrew translations of the Old Testament in synagogues, and the study of the Mishnah is totally banned. The atmosphere hardens, and the disputations start to become dangerous occasions. In 1240 CE, this is in the midst of the time of the Crusades, the later Crusades, one of these disputations is transformed into a frontal attack upon the Talmud. Paris in the 13th century was a maelstrom of religious activity. Waldensians, Cathars, as we talked about yesterday, Jeremy, had started to question the established Catholic Church, and Pope Innocent III announced a violent campaign against them in 1209. But he was innocent, of course. Previous to that, the Bishop of Paris had threatened with excommunication all laymen who took part in theological discussions of any kind. In the midst of all this, a flourishing Talmudic activity was taking place on the right bank of the River Seine. After a 16-year exile, the Jews had been allowed to return to Paris and had immediately established themselves in the area around Les Halles. One of the most important Talmud schools in Central Europe is now established here too. From 1224, its leader, who also becomes the chief rabbi of Paris, is Yechiel. Who's a committed teacher, a rabbi who attracts students from all over Europe. Sometimes even Christian linguists from the other side of the river came to his school for special lessons in Hebrew, strictly illegal. The school has a good reputation, although some of the discussions that take place in and around the Talmud school, and in fact, all over Paris, do worry the already nervous religious establishment in the city. It is absurd to discuss the Trinity on street corners, writes the Christian theologian Peter of Blois. Among the many students who come to Yechiel at this time, there's a young man from La Rochelle called Donin. Donin turns out to be a very independent thinker and a bold one, too. Oh, we don't like them around. Not then, not now. During his time at the school, he started to express a strong dislike for the Talmud, even though he was there to study it. Much could be discussed within these walls, and passionate argumentation around the analysis of Talmud text was what the students devoted themselves to every day. But a condemnation of the Talmud, which was considered to be just as sacred as the five books of Moses, that was quite another story. Yechiel would not tolerate it. The debate raged within the walls of the school for more than a year. Then Yechiel excommunicated his student, Donin, and he did so before the entire congregation. This was extremely cruel punishment at that time. Excommunication meant total exclusion. It was the ban. Nobody spoke with you. Nobody would eat with you. You were a persona non grata. Donin put up with this excommunication for 10 years. Then he took his revenge. In 1236, under dramatic circumstances, Donin declared that he had converted to Christianity. He had himself baptized as Nicholas and joined the Franciscan order. Then he embarked upon a journey. He traveled around France, visiting Anjou, Poitou, and Aquitaine, and he visited crusader soldiers. dressed in a monk's habit, Donin preached against the Jews and Judaism, something which led to the burning of synagogues and the destruction of Torah scrolls. He demanded that the Jews should convert en masse. 500 went along with this, but 3,000 who refused were massacred by the mob. And then finally, in the year 1238, Nicholas Donin made his way to Rome and to Pope Gregory the Ninth. Right, no marriages. Although under Roman law, a person, persona non grata, could still marry an artist, an actress, or a prostitute. There he sought the Pope's help to impose the ultimate punishment, a ban against a hinted Talmud. Donin presents to the Pope 35 accusations against the Talmud for blasphemy and proposes that all copies of the Talmud in the Catholic world be destroyed. Furthermore, he says that if it hadn't been for the Talmud, which he claims the rabbis hold higher than the Bible, the Jews would have long since converted to Christianity. This is exactly what Luther thought 300 years later. He couldn't understand why the Jews weren't filling the Lutheran churches. And then he turned on the Jews himself. Kill them wherever you find them, Luther said. Gregory, the Pope, is angered by what he hears as well as surprised. Until then, the Jews had admittedly been blamed for not having accepted Jesus as their savior, but their books had never been accused of being blasphemous. How could they be? Rather the opposite, the Hebrew Bible basically constituted the Old Testament and the Christian Bible. At the same time, the thing the monk claimed, that it was the Talmud which caused the Jews to stick to their teachings and withstand Christianity, was most upsetting. And the Pope thought about it for the fullness of 1 year. Then he decided to use all the power of the church in a frontal war against the Book of the Jews. And in an encyclical dated June 9, 1239, he asked the rulers of 7 Western European realms to confiscate all the copies of the Talmud in their country. One thing I do like about reading this book, it's written in the historical present tense, like it's happening now, not like it already did happen. We have that in our New Testament. Most of the Gospels is written in the historical historical present tense, like it's happening now, but our translators have put it all in the past tense. Why? I don't know. So much more exciting. Like in the Gospel of Mark, constantly, immediately this happens, immediately that happens, immediately that happens. But the translator said, immediately that had happened, mixing up of tenses. Now, where was I? Only the French king, Louis IX, called Saint Louis, on account of his piety, takes heed to the Pope's request. On the morning of the Shabbat, Saturday, March 3rd, 1240, all copies of the Talmud found in France are confiscated and transported to a monastery in Gay Paris. Then follows a trial. King Louis had a mother who was known to be very determined. While her son was still an underage regent, Blanche of Castile had governed France herself and indeed waged war against the heretic Albigensians in Languedoc. Oh, I'd like to do something with them. The Albigensians, Languedoc. Jeremy, why don't you put together something for that? You'd be really good at that one. Now, it was she who was given the task of sitting as the judge for the approaching trial against the Talmud. She probably made the decision herself. It's said that Blanche still, to a considerable degree, decided all for her son. But on July 24th, 1240, the court proceedings began, and they are to take place in the royal palace. In the magnificent great hall, Queen Blanche makes her entrance and assumes her position on the dais. She's followed by the prosecutor, and he is no other than the person who is considered most suited and most familiar with the Talmud's blasphemous qualities, Nicholas Donin. 4 French rabbis, all leading figures within French Jewry, have been appointed to defend their holy scripture. The first to speak is Yahiel. This is a book is on trial here, not people. The situation could hardly have been more charged. The controversy, now almost 2 decades old, between the teacher and his obstinate and severely punished student, had now led to the very Talmud being put on trial. Donin had achieved what he wanted, and the man who once had crushed him now sat there with his beloved book on the bench of the accused Queen Blanche, and had every reason to expect an exciting battle. Reminds us of Luther and Eck and their debates. Luther and Eck. You know, all these Catholic debaters, even when they debated the Albigensians in France, Catholics always lost, whereas the Catholics would always be quoting church fathers. The Albigensians, the Cathars, whoever the other one was, they would be quoting the scripture, which, of course, the Catholic debaters probably knew nothing about. Nicholas Donan had brought with him all the volumes of the Talmud to the trial. Now he lifted one of the volumes up high so that everyone could see. Note the historic present tense. Then he carried it toward the spectators so that they could discern the text. Next, he turned toward his former teacher and asked him whether he believed everything that was written in these more than 400-year-old books to be true. 400 years, cried Yechiel. They are 1,500 years old. Then he sarcastically asked his former pupil which part of the Jewish faith he wanted to discuss. Donan's answer came as a total surprise to the rabbi. He didn't want to discuss any articles of faith of Judaism at all, nor did he wish to discuss the 35 accusations he had presented to Pope Gregory. Instead, explained the monk, the discussion would be about one and only one thing, the presentation of Jesus Christ in the Talmud. The rabbi was astounded. The discussion would be about something quite different than what he had expected. He turned to the queen. Lady, I beg you, he said, do not oblige me to reply. The Talmud is a holy book of venerable antiquity in which no one until the present has been able to discover a fault. Jerome, one of your saints, was familiar with all of our law. If he had found the least blemish in it, he scarcely would have allowed it to remain. Your doctors, and you have had many more learned than Nicholas these last 1,500 years, have never attacked the Talmud. Then Yechiel turned to the gathered. No further that we are prepared to die for the Talmud. Now the queen, I was going to comment there, but you're thinking the same thing I'm thinking. Now the queen interrupts and assures Yechiel that nobody is threatening the Jews or their property, but the rabbi must answer the accusations concerning the Talmud. It's Donan's turn to speak again. And he immediately, this is a funny thing, Donan, I worked at a Presbyterian theological seminary up the road here for a few years, and the guy that ran it, his name was Donan. And in order for me even to work there, because they considered me to be an Arminian, somebody that believed in predestination, I had to go and answer questions at their council. And anytime I would talk to Donan about anything Hebrew, or even about the Old Testament, he would say, now, you know what we think about that, Jackson. If you want to keep working here, you won't bring up subjects like that. I wonder why that name sounded familiar to me in that same context. The monk reads aloud the sections he finds relevant, 20 in all, and translates them into French. 20, yes, but only a couple can even be seen as applying to Yahshua. When he's finished, he turns to the listeners. See how this people insults your God. How do you allow them to live in your midst? Yechiel could not have expected this, and he was hardly prepared, but his answer is not long in coming. There's nothing in those passages that Nicholas just read out that is about Jesus. They're about completely different people. Rabbi Yechiel is so sure of his case, and he argues so well that Donan now starts hurling abuse at him. By the way, my Donan, he passed away last September, so he's a blessed memory. Finally, Queen Blanche interrupts again. Why do you spill your good odor? Odor, she asked the monk. The Jew, out of respect for you, has succeeded in proving that his ancestors did not insult your God, and yet you persist in trying to make him confess to blasphemies? Aren't you shamed by such maneuvers? Yechiel is declared innocent, but the Talmud is not. It's decided that there should be a retrial of the Jews' holy book, and this time it will take place before a church tribunal. Speaking of heresies in the Hebrew Roots movement, I point out a heresy in one movement, the heresy of ordaining people to the Melchizedek priesthood, which is a total fallacy. And so I did a show on that, and next thing I know, some people from the West Coast started writing me hate mail. I was nice in what I said. Sometimes you have to come against evil. And I said to them, look, fellows, I will debate you anytime on this Melchizedek subject, as long as the debate is open and fair. They said, well, you can do that, but it has to be a private debate among our people. Now they're putting the same guy to that test. Of course I wouldn't do that. They're putting them now before a church council, and we've already read how these guys are so stirred up against the Talmud anyway. And probably nobody in the church council even knew any of this stuff. But the second council ends in a quite different manner than the first, of course. The Talmud is declared to be a tissue of lies and condemned to be consumed to the fire. Oh, let's see. In June 1242, wagon upon wagon leaves the monastery of Paris, where the volumes have been stored, and all the known copies of the Talmud in France are cast into the flames.
Your friend Bogdan will be right back after these important messages. Now Jackson Snyder is back on Bogdan Shrumkov Presents, sponsored by the Vero Essinyahad, a Hebrew Nation radio original.
I want to get down to what it actually says here. So what was actually written about Jesus, or the person who possibly is Jesus, in the Talmud? By the way, before this, they were able to bring out Talmud, but it had to be censored. It had to be censored of those passages. And that censored edition was the basis for later editions. So when you read Talmud, if you do, you might not be getting the same thing as these people do. Yeshu ben Pantera, ben Stada, Balaam, Piloni. Not just one, but several names in the Talmud have been associated with Jesus. The names that might well be regarded as most relevant in this context are Yeshu ben Pantera, or Pandira, or Pandera, or simply ben Pantera, which means son of Pantera. Of course, Pantera is German, or Old German, for panther. And Ben Stada, son of Stada. And sometimes, as in the following lines, the authors of the Talmud confirmed that these names refer to one and the same person. And this they did to Ben Stada in Lydda, and they hung him on the eve of Passover. Ben Stada was Ben Pandira. So what I'm saying is, in the Talmud, there are certain people in there that have been picked out by these heretic hunters as being referenced to their God in the Talmud. Yechiel said, no, these are all different people. We're not referencing Jesus there any place. They're all different, which spoiled his case, and then he had to go to a different, more favorable courtroom after that. A similar identification is made in another tractate. Rabbi Eliezer said to the sages, but did not Ben Stada bring forth witchcraft from Egypt? That's an important point, Egypt. By means of scratches in the form of charms upon his flesh? In other words, incantations were scratched into his flesh. He was a fool, answered they, and proof cannot be adduced from fools. Was he then the son of Stada? Surely he was the son of Pantera. I think I told a little about the Pantera legend before. Yeah, you know what it is, that, as I said before, that Mary the hairdresser was raped or gave herself as a prostitute to Pantera, who was a centurion stationed on the west coast of Israel, or I should say Lebanon now, and that they found some evidence that they used in this same case, where I should say they found the tombstone of Pantera years later in Germany, outside his hometown. I think it talks more about that in here. I'm sure you're familiar with that, though. What the above quote treats is the question of whether one may, under any circumstances, write on the Sabbath. For example, by scratching one's skin. This is another accusation about the Sabbath, whether he could scratch on his skin. A footnote talks about taking your fingernail and scratching. You know, sometimes you can do that. You can see a mark there for a while. But this is evidently something you would take something much sharper and cut into your skin, or tattoo into your skin, probably what they're talking about. But on Shabbat? But the question is whether, despite this, one can find fragments of historical truth. And that's what we're looking for. You know, even in the worst texts, like the apocalypses of Jacob, James, they're pretty wild. But there are some scraps of historical information in there that we can take out that is just too common to ignore as historical information. There is a tradition that he had something to do with Egypt. Later on in the book, she talks about the Egyptian Messiah. You might remember in Josephus and in the Gospel of the Acts of the Apostles, we have the Egyptian coming up from Egypt to the top of Mount Zion with troops, 4,000 troops, I think, to watch for the destruction of Jerusalem. But it says that somebody sent troops against them, killed about 400, but the Egyptian got away. Of course, the legend about Yahshua is he came out of Egypt. And if we're to believe these latest blood tests on the shroud and on the Mandylion, he was Egyptian. Druze, a minor racial group that comes out of Egypt and now lives in Bethlehem and around there. I'm surprised how many people never heard of the Druze people. There's a lot of them in Israel right now, and they are by and large on the side of the Israelis rather than on the side of the Arabs there. So the Druze are helpful there right now, but they keep their head down. They took that blood, they checked it against the people living in Nazareth, I should say, not Bethlehem. They matched against the people now living in Nazareth, and they found the exact same DNA strain. Now, that was a great disappointment to the young pastor who put this all together. When they said to the pastor, it was kind of the tour guide here, if you saw this documentary, he was crestfallen. And they said, no, he's not a blood Jew. He's a Druze. And of course, back in those days, the Druze were Jews, but no Jews were Druze. Get it? Catch that play on words? He who scratches the skin in the fashion of writing is guilty, but he who marks on the skin in the fashion of writing is exempt from punishment. Think about that when you get a tattoo on the Sabbath. Rabbi Eliezer said to them, but has not Ben Stada brought magic spells out of Egypt just in this way? They answered him, on account of one fool, we do not ruin a multitude of reasonable men. Skipping down. It is incidentally remarkable that in the Revelation of John, the last book in the New Testament, we can read the following lines about one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. The man on the white horse, a person who is often interpreted as Jesus Christ. His eyes flamed like fire, and on his head were many diadems. Written on him was a name known to none but himself. On his robe and on his thigh was written the title, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. This is not part of the Four Horsemen. This is later on. She made a little mistake here. I'm surprised she didn't call the book Revelations. We have if a lot here. If we accept that Ben Stada and Yeshua ben Pentara refer to Jesus of Nazareth, then he does seem to have some connection with Egypt. Of course he did, just like it says in the Gospel of Matthew. There's all kinds of tradition about Yeshua in Egypt, and I found some myself. That is, the Alfe priesthood, which certainly that family was involved in southern Egypt. We should talk about that sometime. That's interesting. Yeshua in Egypt. And if this is the case, he does seem to have acquired a certain knowledge of magic there. Understand, this magic is that which strong faith brings forth. Magic then and magic now doesn't mean the same thing. In those days, the word sorcery is what we understand as magic. But in doing miraculous works in the course of practicing one's religion, at that time, it was called magic. It's like we have these potentates from Parthia coming over. They're called magoi or magi, magicians, astrologers. This book calls them astrologers. They need to go a little farther with this and find out about the magoi class from Parthia. It's easy to learn and find out that those people were of the tribes of Israel who were held by the kings of Parthia to be the wisest men in the country. And if they were going to go looking for a new king, which they did all the time, their kings were horrible. Rome often took their kings out. They went looking for kings. They certainly wouldn't have sent three old men or astrologers in to see Herod. They would have gone in fully armed with troops, 10, 20,000 troops. The Magi were not magicians. They were the upper crust of the Parthian intelligentsia who found their roots in Israel in the dispersion and whose job it was to find candidates for the various kingly offices of Parthia. Parthia, I'm off the subject. Parthia, the empire that nobody knows about, though it's right next to Israel, right to the east of Israel, had a lot to do with Israel's history and Roman history as well. Dire enemies of the Romans. We hear about Rome, but we don't hear about Parthia. In fact, where do you think we get the name Farsi from? Or Pharisee, sorry. The belief in magic, that is to say, in the power of magical names and spells and enchantments and formulae and pictures and figures and amulets and in the performance of ceremonies, accompanied by the utterance of words of power to produce supernatural results, formed a large and important part of Egyptian religion, says Budge in his old book from 100 years ago. All right, let me try to get into some more of this. One thing I appreciate about this book is that it's already come with everything underlined in it, just as though I were going to do it. Einhorn makes a note, and it's a good one, an aside. Interesting how the Gospels define certain groups as Jews, especially in the Gospel of John. Yeshua is never part of the Jews. It's always them, even the feasts of the Jews. John 1, Philip says, we have found the man of whom Moses wrote in the law, the man foretold by the prophets. It is Yeshua, son of Yosef, from Nazareth. And in chapter 6, a group of Jews say, surely this is Jesus, Joseph's son. It's, by the way, interesting how the Gospels define certain groups of Jews. It's interesting for the simple reason that virtually all the people in the settings Jesus finds himself, including the disciples, and Jesus himself are Jews. They're in a Jewish country, yet there's a distinct expression of alienation, of being an outsider. About Jesus is just and distinct is the fact that this alienation is defined in relation to Jews. In the lines above from the Gospel of John, Jesus even seems to distinguish between the ancestry of the Jews and that of himself. So prevalent. People want to just look over that. Psychological interpretations are always tricky in a context such as this. We are speaking of a religious figure. Described in religious texts written down about 2,000 years ago, much has been rephrased, much has been rationalized. If we really are going to try to get the reality that may lie behind the lines, psychology must be one of our tools, even though it means venturing out onto thin ice. Have you read Jesus and Paul by James Tabor? Psychological profile of Paul. This is very good. Because the thing is that intimations of illegitimacy are not just found in the Gospels, they are in at least two other sources, and depending upon how much faith we put in these, they can possibly give us an explanation for the alienation Jesus felt. Think of him coming back to Nazareth. I think that's Luke 4. He comes back. Nobody recognizes him until he finally gets up, speaks the text, heals somebody. Then he's recognized, just like at Emmaus. He's recognized in a work, breaking of bread. His own brothers finally recognize him then. In Nazareth, when he does a healing, he's recognized. Well, in Mark, it says, is this not Mary's son? But in Matthew, that's corrected. Is this not son of the carpenter Joseph? Corrected. I was thinking, if we dared to take the stance that Jesus was not God himself, and that Philippians chapter 2, the canonic hymn, he emptied himself, came like a man, was truly an ancient Christian hymn, how could this person be any more lowly born than he was? Let's just take for a minute, take for granted these things that are said about him. So he's an Egyptian. It's pretty clear that his family did come from Egypt, by the way. He's a Druze. He's illegitimate, a momser. He's a scandal in his hometown. He has to leave his hometown. He's such a scandal. Thus, he was not allowed, at least to those who knew him, to go to any school. He wasn't allowed there as a mamzer. Where did he go? Hid out. Where would they take in children like that? Why isn't this explained? It goes on and on in books about Jesus. They say, well, there's no really written sources for him before a certain day, you know, until 50 years later. How could there be? If this man is so lowly born and he is exalted through his life for his good works and his Torah keeping, nobody, when he was born, would start taking up the pen and write about him. Just the opposite. They'd be scandalized by him. The earliest reference that by some is regarded as coming as concerning Jesus is also the only one in the Mishnah, said Rabbi Shimon ben Azai. I found a roll of genealogical records in Jerusalem, and therein was written Peloni is the illegitimate child of an adulteress, or in the original language, it's momser, which means bastard. The only reason at all for suspecting this concerns Jesus is the use of the name Peloni. I guess that means Jesus was an Italian, too. It can be compared with John Doe in American legal text. That is, a person whose name one deliberately does not provide. The name Peloni has been associated with Jesus, and the view has been put forward that the above Mishnah quote is indeed about Jesus. Many scholars consider the assumption to be preposterous, or at the very least far-fetched. But Shimon ben Azai was, incidentally, a scribe who lived at the end of the first century and beginning of the second. In the Gemara, which of course was put together later, there are a number of lines that concern Ben Pantera, Peloni, Ben Stada. In general, the names turn up in texts that are about a person who is trying to lead the Jews away from their religion. And in some of them, this person's origin is touched upon. It seems to me that the historical Yahshua was trying to lead the people back to true religion. Of course, what was normative Judaism in 1 BC? It wasn't Phariseeism or Sadduceeism. The primary sources tell you what it was. He was part of it. Here's a quote. Rabbi Eliezer said to the sages, "But did not Ben Stada bring forth witchcraft from Egypt by means of scratches in the form of charms upon his flesh?" "He was a fool," answered they, "and proof cannot be adduced from fools." "Was he then the son of Stada?" "Surely he was the son of Pandera," said Rabbi Hisda. "The husband was Stada. The paramour was Pandera," in the feminine case, feminine gender. Another said, "But the husband was Papos ben Yuda. His mother was Stada." Another said, "But his mother was Miriam, the hairdresser. It is as we say in Pumbeditha, Stathda, Stathda, Stada. Literally, she has turned away from a husband or her husband." That's pretty confusing to me. I think what she's trying to show here is that in the Talmud, they're trying to link these personages up with Jesus, just as they have tried to link up Yeshu in the Toledoth Yeshu 100 years before the first century, at least that's where it's placed historically, with him as well. Some similar lines. "This they did to Ben Stada in Lydda, and they hung him on the eve of Passover." Ben Stada was Ben Pandera. We mentioned that before. Stada is supposed to be the husband, Pandera the wife, but neither one of those are actual names, but titles. But now let's get on Mary for a while. She points out something worthwhile for the historian here. Miriam is the Jewish name for Mary. You know, the Jewish name for Mary is Maria. Miriam is the Hebrew name. Maria is the Aramaic name. And the Jewish name? All right. And this can perhaps provide more credibility to the assumption that the above text is actually about Jesus. What is meant by the dresser of women's hair? The original Aramaic expression is Megadela, Megadela Neshaya, Megadela Neshaya. And the mother is just called Miriam Megadela Ashaya. What does it sound like? What's interesting is that Miriam or Mary or Maria is here given almost the same name as Mary Magdalene or Mary from Magdala. Of course, the Acts of Philip tells us her name was Mariamne. Names, games, pseudonyms, antonyms, aliases, pseudonyms. Oh, I said that one. Surnames, code names. How interesting this is. I wish I could get together a code name club. There's got to be some way to do these names games with cards, you know, and little marker pieces and, you know, a lot of play money. To place Papos ben Yuda in the period is, however, harder since he was a real person, a scribe who lived at least a half century after Yeshua, and among other things, is said to have locked his wife in the house to stop her from being unfaithful. I wanted to do that with my first wife, but it was her house. It's possible that Papos ben Yuda can here be serving as a metaphor for a deceived husband. The text is full of puns. Here, for example, is an interpretation of which the origin of the name Stada might be. Stathda means to turn him away or to turn away from. It seems here to thus have the meaning unfaithful, turn away from her husband, Stada. This suspicion of adultery is also expressed clearly and unambiguously when it was written, "The husband was Stada, the paramour Pandera." Ben Stada and Ben Pandera are here said to be the same person with two different names, which is explained by one of them designating him as son to the step to his stepfather or mother, the other as son to his mother's lover. That is confusing. Oh, there was one place I wanted to get here. Maybe we'll have to wait till next time. This is a good book if you want to run through of lower higher criticism stuff in the first few chapters. It's a really good refresher. Who then was Pandera or Pantera or Pandera, the presumed lover? One suggestion, which I don't think holds water, is that the word can be derived from Parthenos, which in classic Greek means virgin, and that Ben Pandera would thus mean son of a virgin. But Pandera and Parthenos does not sound close enough to me. The obvious appropriateness of a name indicating the alleged birth of Yeshua from a virgin might make us overlook the improbability that the form Parthenos should be Hebraized into the form Pandera when the Greek word could have been reproduced almost unchanged in a Hebrew form. True? Is it not clear, moreover, why in the Talmud a Greek word should have been chosen as an epithet for Jesus, whatever that means? The Greek was, however, attracted other interpretations of the name, and one suggestion is that it could derive from pantheros, which means father-in-law, or quite simply, from the name Panther. But has this name, Pandira, Pantera, actually been used as a personal name? Yes, it does. And here we talk about the archaeological find of 1859, and I'll end with that. Caused quite a sensation among those who were engaged in research on the historical Jesus in the German Rhineland. Anybody here from the Rhineland originally? Jawohl! Jawohl! Achtung! Grenade! I grew up on World War II movies, and these big plastic army men this big, mostly German army, we use BB guns on those guys. I know that's terrible, but kids game. In a little village called Bingerbrook, work had been started on the extension of a railway line. During the excavation work, a number of gravestones were suddenly uncovered. To their surprise, archaeologists discovered the stones to be extremely old, from the first and second centuries. I'm going to look at these chats here in a minute to end up this paragraph. On some of these stones, the inscriptions were still fairly legible. They were in Latin, and it was clear that some of the graves had been of Roman soldiers, presumably with a high rank. One particular stone gave rise to a lot of attention. The gravestone with its statue was about 5 feet high and about 2.5 feet wide and portrayed an archer. The head, neck, and shoulders were broken off. Can you imagine why? Can you imagine how the head might have gotten broken off this tombstone? I don't know if you've seen it or not. I've got pictures of it. You've probably already seen it. The head, neck, and shoulders were broken off, but otherwise the statue was well preserved. And most important of all, the greater part of the inscription remained. It read, Tiberius Julius Abdes Pantera Sidonia Anorum Lx II. 62, I think. Stipendiorum XXXX miles. The cohort 1 Sagittorum, Sagittariorum, that's genitive plural, hic situs est, that is Tiberius Julius Abdes Pantera from Sidon. Didn't Jesus go up and visit Sidon, Tyre and Sidon? It's interesting that it's that far away. 62 years of age, with 40 years of service, a soldier in the first cohort of archers rests here. This archer's company is understood to have been stationed at Bingerbrook in the middle of the first century and was based in Syria until about the year 6 AD. Did you hear a bell ringing in your head at that date? In other words, the surname was Pantera. Seems to have been lived at the right time, or at least close to the right time, to be able to have been the father of Jesus, and the supposition that the soldier Pantera was a non-Jew, father of Jesus, and perhaps even lay in German soil, came eventually to be used in a new Nazified theology. Could it be that they had found Jesus' biological father? Actually, they had no other evidence than the surname. Besides, Pantera was not unknown as a surname for Roman soldiers, Panthers. Besides, Pantera was not, there are even other inscriptions found that bear this name. Nevertheless, here was proof that the name Ben Pantera, son of Pantera, could actually refer to a personal name, at least a Roman personal name, rather than just be a play on words. In the seminary at St. Vincent de Paul, we were discussing the life and death of Yahshua. Somebody asked the professor, what do you think happened to him? The professor said, it's pretty obvious to me that he was eaten by dogs. There's got to be some faith in this. What about my Jesus? But if this Jewish myth were true, not unlike the one about the stolen tomb, it would make no difference to me, none. I hope not to you. So many people lose their faith when their learning cannot outstrip their religion. Yes, being removed from all community life, moms are no education, no family, no friendships, no marriages, no nothing. Robin Schaefer is from the Rhineland, Obregheim. I'm from around Darmstadt in Hesse. My ancestor there was a mercenary for Napoleon. We've got a write-up about him on a tombstone. I do a message about that. He said that he received a commendation in the German army. But I looked from that time, and there was no German army. And then I read that the people in Hesse were sold out during the winter months to powers at war. Every farmer in Hesse that was able became a mercenary for 6 months of the year. And only 1 in 5 came back. They sent them to Russia. They sent them to America and to Spain. And in some of the notes I have on this ancestor, why did he leave Hesse? He was tired of war, seeing all his people dying, being just one of the 20% that survived. We got a lot of Hessians in the United States now that came over to fight against the Continental Army. And when they lost, they just stayed here. A lot of farmers. Maybe you're part of that bunch, Robin. Any questions or comments?
Time is up, but if you have question or comment, address them to veroyahad@gmail.com. One of our many secretaries will honor your request and send you information immediately.